In 1948, the people in the British colony of Newfoundland faced a choice. They could become an independent dominion within the British Empire, or they could vote to join Canada in Confederation.
The anti-Confederates are not going to get away with it.
But St. John's was an anti-Confederate headquarters.
Watch in particular the attractive bait which will be held out to lure our country into the Canadian mousetrap.
Listen to the Stories Behind the History podcast for our special series, How Did Newfoundland Join Canada? Available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
This is The Secret Life of Canada, a podcast about the country you know and the stories you don't. And just a warning, this episode contains strong language and mature themes, because history does sometimes.
General Idea has injected a good dose of humor into the art world here in Canada and around the world. They specialize in multimedia work that parodies consumer culture and mass media.
In their high-tech work, they send up society's devotion to fashion. They've produced television shows which satirize talk show and sitcom formats.
When most of us think of Canadian art, the names that come to mind are Tom Thompson, A.Y. Jackson, maybe Alex Colville. But one of the biggest names in Canadian art these days is attached to a group of artists whose sly humor and ironic wit masks a keen insight into contemporary life.
General Idea is a trio of Toronto artists, A.A. Bronson, Felix Parts, and Jorge Zontal.
You may not know about them, but they know something about you.
Hey, Leah.
Hey, Phelan. So we're going to dive into a bit of art and cultural history here today. Do you know anything about General Idea?
A little bit. I've heard of them, but I don't know if I knew that they were Canadian.
Yeah, I bet a lot of people have seen General Idea's work, but if they're not really familiar with the art world, they might not even know who they are or that they're Canadian.
And why do you think that is?
Because, how do I say this? Their work is amazing. It's unreal.
And people don't know who they are because their work is amazing.
No, because I think that people look at the kind of stuff that General Idea has created and assume it's from somewhere else. I'm sorry. I think our collective Canadian low self-esteem doesn't think that we would produce anything that cool.
Right. Yes. Yeah, I agree.
But, you know, the other reason is that also Canada didn't really accept them in the beginning. Their work was much more well-received in other parts of the world.
And that is very typical.
It is. So today we're going to look into General Idea because they didn't just create art. They challenged norms. They pushed boundaries. They were unapologetically queer, funny, subversive, and they redefined what it meant to be an artist in Canada. We will put some links to their work in the description for people to look at. And I think most of it just looks and feels so incredibly current and timely, even though the core years that they were producing this was, you know, between the 70s and the 90s.
Okay, so I'm in. Who were the minds behind this avant-garde collective?
They met in Toronto in 1968. Michael Timms and Ron Gabe came separately from Winnipeg. George Sayas studied architecture in Halifax. They took on pseudonyms. Timms became A.A. Bronson, Gabe became Felix Parts, and Sayas became Jorge Zontal. They found themselves sharing a house with a mutual friend, and General Idea was born.
So General Idea, as most people know them today, are three people. Ronald Gabe, Slobodan Saya Levy, and Michael Timms. They all adopted pseudonyms, so Ronald became Felix Parts. Slobodan went with Jorge Zontal, which was inspired by a song he liked, and Michael became A.A. Bronson, which is a play on a name that he came up with in a porn novel that he co-wrote. But, okay. You know, when they started out, it was a much larger group with many people.
We started as a group of seven or eight, a rather vague group of seven or eight. And we didn't reduce to our final size of three for about 3 or 4 years.
This is A.A. Bronson. He was born in Vancouver. He currently lives in Berlin, and he is the last surviving member of General Idea. He told me about how the group got started and how they all came together at this one particular house in Toronto in the late 60s.
The first year was at Girard Street. There was no shower in that little house, so We had a wading pool set up in the basement with a hose, and the hose had no access to hot water, only cold water. So we could have, cold showers in the basement in the wading pool. And we were so poor and we couldn't really afford it. So the house was always freezing cold as well.
Hose shower. Familiar. I'm very familiar. I did that on the res when I was a kid, totally.
Oh, yeah. I mean, hoses can be very effective showers. AA had been traveling across Canada doing work in and about cooperatives and communes. It was the 60s. And when he arrived in Toronto, he found a like-minded friend and artist named Mimi Page.
Mimi knew who I was, so I became Mimi's roommate. And I was there for a few months until I found my own situation. And then in the meantime, Felix had arrived.
So Felix grew up in Winnipeg, and he had attended University of Manitoba's School of Art. Then Jorge showed up from Halifax. Jorge was actually born in Italy in a concentration camp. His parents were Jewish from Yugoslavia, and then eventually they immigrated to Venezuela, and then he moved to Halifax to study architecture at Dalhousie University.
It all went very fast. Before I knew it, Mimi came up with the idea that we should all live together.
Okay, so they're living together. Mm-hmm. Did they just start making art right away?
Yeah, but it wasn't like they were a group with a clear directive to become, serious artists. At this point, they were just, students. Some were unemployed artists, and they were just having fun, really.
It was an open-ended group. I mean, we started just as housemates. We weren't a group at all. But we very quickly started doing projects together because we were living in a kind of storefront. And so there was a ready-made exhibition space right there. And whoever felt like it joined in, and different kinds of people took different kinds of roles.
Here's AA in the 70s describing the kind of work they did at the house on Girard Street.
But we found ourselves entertaining ourselves by making fake stores in that window. And we would sort through the garbage of the neighborhood at night and find stuff to put up for sale the next day. One day we opened a store of nurse novels. And that since the house was located next door to a nurse's residence, that seemed appropriate. So I think, in a way, General Idea started just by fooling around. We had really a year of living in this house and fooling around, doing all these fake stores. And we had an exhibition in the space, a sort of group exhibition of the three of us independently.
Their projects evolved into larger and more elaborate installations. And during this period, they explored various forms of art, including performance art, photography, video, and printing.
And so how did they get their name? Like, it's a great name, by the way.
It is a great name.
We were invited by A Space, which at that time was the only artist-run gallery in Toronto. This is in the early 70s. We were invited to propose a project, which we did, and they misunderstood and thought that the project name was our name. So we called the project General Idea, and we had no name for ourselves. But they misunderstood, and we thought, well, that does make a kind of good name for the group. So we stuck with it.
It's great they didn't take themselves too seriously. I feel like that's when really good art happens, when it's not so serious.
I agree. It feels like they really liked to have fun. They were always together. They were hitting up parties, showing up in style at, gallery receptions with an entourage. They were performance artists through and through, staging entrances to make a statement, create a bit of buzz, which is maybe part of the reason that the Canadian art world didn't really love them at first. Like, I think they were kind of showy. But, their work was a serious critique of media and culture. Europe got it. Canada, not so much. Here are the three of them being interviewed by Mary Ambrose on CBC.
Perhaps it's the multitude of mediums they use, or the fact that they're three people operating as one. Maybe it was their ironic treatment of cultural themes. But very few people in Canada have taken General Idea into their hearts. A.A. Bronson and Jorge Zuntel agree that their Canadian audience is a bit uneasy with their work.
It's suspect, basically, that you're putting them on. I'm not sure what putting them on actually means in terms of work. I mean, why would we bother to spend 15 years to put you on? But there is that that innate Scottish suspicion that they're being made fools of. I don't know if it's Scottish,
I think it is.
Oh, I think just because they thought of us as conceptual artists, you know, that it was... In Europe in general, they thought of us as intellectuals. In Canada, they thought of us as clowns.
Yeah, again, Canada.
Yeah. Wah, wah.
Oh, no, God.
but you know, by 1970, General Idea had moved into a loft above a restaurant in Toronto's financial district, and group membership was basically everyone they worked and lived with was part of the General Idea.
The Yonge Street property was the third and fourth floor, and that it had been more or less abandoned. So it was very, very cheap and gigantic. It was, you know, probably about 5,000 square feet. But it was lots of room to do things, very, very cheap. But again, we had to put up with the fact that, for example, the restaurant on the ground floor had their office in the middle of our apartment, if you want to call it, whatever you want to call it. So they would come and go, and the waiters would be bonking the waitresses in the office.
And this is why I get depressed every time a derelict building gets turned into a condo in Toronto, because old weird buildings are where art thrives, you know?
Yes, and, you know, and where waitresses get laid.
It's
Ask
true.
Me. I was once a waitress.
Okay, well.
but you need cheap space. You do need cheap space for artists to thrive.
Yes, that's my theory anyway. This is why I believe there are more exciting things going on artistically in Winnipeg and Montreal, because there's still old, broken down buildings in those places, you know?
Yeah. Okay, so you're pro-blight.
When it comes to art making, I am pro-blight, yes. So it's during this time when they are in a semi-abandoned building on Yonge Street. That's when they start to explore all these different forms of work, including what we would now call zines.
You know, the underground newspapers happened, and you could produce a newspaper for almost no money. Before that, it would have been very expensive. And that gave rise to the underground paper.
So new independent publishers were cropping up. Coach House Press, which is now known as Coach House Books, was an instrumental printing house.
And then when places like Coach House Press started to set up, almost always using old, forgotten equipment that had to be managed by hand, there was a whole generation of hippies, let's say, who wanted to learn how to use it. There were all these little printing houses where you could go and have a flyer printed or something like that. And really, zines start in the mid-70s. When these copy shops started proliferating like crazy. They weren't called zines then. So there was a generation of people doing zines, but without the word zine.
Zines before zines. Okay, very cool.
Yeah, and along with this kind of printing, they began to use the mail. Here's an interview from 1973 where AA explains what they would also call mail art or correspondence art.
Well, around the world, totally encircling the globe, there's quite a complex network of artists in every country working through the mails, working using the postal system as a medium, much as a painter might use paint. What's interesting about the postal medium is that it encompasses all other media. Tapes can be sent through the mail, videotapes could be sent through the mail, paintings could be sent through the mail, letters can be sent through the mail, photographs can be sent through the mail. And all these networks of artists then are sending things back and forth, adding to each other's art, creating really a vision of art and a method of art that is collective in nature.
It sounds like kind of like an early version of Tumblr or early social media, but like a tangible version.
Exactly. And the mail would also play a big part in one of their most well-known projects, File Magazine.
It's a play on Life magazine, and the logo was a play on the Life magazine logo. It was just the letters were just rearranged, which, of course, one day we received a letter from a lawyer at Life magazine.
So Life magazine was one of the most popular and recognizable American magazines. You know, you probably, most people have seen a Life magazine cover at this point. Their covers are especially notable. They're full of cultural icons of the time. And General Idea decided to subvert the magazine's iconography. And they did it at a moment where the magazine was shut down for a couple years. File started in 1972. Life magazine was owned by Time Life, and despite it being shut down for a bit, the company found out about File, and they were not impressed.
But we got a letter from Time Life threatening to take us to court. And, you know, in our usual way, we took this as a wonderful opportunity for some self-promotion. And with the Mail Art Network, of course, we immediately sent out information about this, copies to everybody we could think of. And in New York, the kind of newspaper of the day got hold of this information and phoned us and interviewed us and published two consecutive articles, basically making fun of Time Life for chasing, you know, this little artist collective that had no money and had published, you know, six magazines that hardly anybody had seen. We got such good press out of it. And before we knew it, the lawyer had been taken off the case and another lawyer had been put in his place. And he just said, well, you know, redesign your logo and we'll forget about it.
So they changed it slightly, but by then had received a ton of press about it.
Right. So it's that all press is good press idea. Mm-hmm. If Life had never sued them, maybe we wouldn't be making an episode about General Idea.
Yeah, probably not. It was huge for them. Here's Felix talking with a CBC reporter in 1978, and he's describing General Idea's latest cover of File, which included some pretty famous people.
And the latest issue is a special punk rock issue, which is sort of called Punk Till You Puke.
Read us the cover.
Well, we have up in the upper left-hand corner is sort of a lime green splat with lettering on it saying Punk Till You Puke, which is sort of splatting over the logo, which is File, of course, in pink. Then it tells, you know, who's in the issue, like the Sex Pistols, Richard Hell, Rough Trade, the Dead Boys. And, of course, the cover girl is Debbie Harry, who's the blonde in Blondie, the New York rock group, which is quite popular. And she's looking quite glamorous, except for a small gold chain around her neck with a little gold skull and crossbones.
And while they made a splash with File magazine, they were also working on a lot of other projects around this same time period.
If we look at your group historically, would you say that File magazine was the thing that really put you on the map, that made everybody aware that you, across the country, especially in the U.S. too?
I suppose internationally, yeah, File is the thing that put us on the map. But the 1971 Miss General Idea pageant was the first big project we did. That was a year earlier than File.
The Miss General Idea pageant was also a key part of the group's work in the 1970s.
I love a pageant. Mm-hmm. So are we talking like toddlers in tiara styles, like gowns and tiaras,
I mean,
and bouquets?
Somewhat, but also bear costumes and, you know, a funeral arrangement and panels of judges. Here's how John Bentley Mays, who was an art critic at the time, described the pageants to CBC in 1985.
You know, look out there and say, okay, what if our relationships with the world were basically those in a beauty pageant? And you get some idea, I think, of the way in which General Idea has been understanding mass culture. And it's pretty damn smart. They understand the way that glamour and fantasy operate. They understand the way that sexual desire gets all mixed up with power in modern society. And so each of their installations that they have done is dealing with one or another moment in that process. But that, I think, is the process, that investigation.
It was the most eclectic beauty pageant you could think of, and it all started at a theater in Toronto.
And so we did the Miss General Idea pageant. The idea was that the art world is a little bit like a beauty pageant, you know, that there's contestants, there's winners, losers, there's prizes, especially back then. There were no women artists. I mean, basically, women artists barely existed. They existed in art school, where they were always over half the classes. But in the art world, you could not find women. So the Miss General Idea pageant was a kind of a metaphor for the art world, a kind of picture of the art world.
It's at this point in the mid-70s that the group decided to start playing with the idea of calling one of the pageants Miss General Idea 1984.
Okay, so this is the 70s. So why are they calling it, you know, Miss General Idea 1984? Even it was years away.
Yeah, well, they wanted to play with the idea of a dystopian future.
So it was based on George Orwell's novel, 1984, which projects a kind of horrific future. And so we stole that name, 1984, and we decided that we would live and work together until 1984. And what that did was it gave us an end date.
Oh, wow. So they picked an end date for the group.
Yeah. AA told me that because he knew about communes and communal activity, he knew that groups eventually fall apart because there's never a coherent picture of what the group is doing or how long they would stay together. So by choosing an end date, it solved all of that.
Okay, so what happened in 1984?
Then when 1984 came around, it was like a bad habit we couldn't get rid of. You know, we were used to being with each other and couldn't imagine it any other way.
The 1980s would see General Idea rise to become one of the most influential art collectives of the 20th century. But it would also see them face something that would be responsible for inspiring some of their best-known work and at the same time destroy them, the AIDS epidemic.
In 1948, the people in the British colony of Newfoundland faced a choice. They could become an independent dominion within the British Empire, or they could vote to join Canada in Confederation.
The anti-Confederates are not going to get away with it.
But St. John's was an anti-Confederate headquarters.
Watch in particular the attractive bait which will be held out to lure our country into the Canadian mousetrap.
Listen to the Stories Behind the History podcast for our special series, How Did Newfoundland Join Canada? Available now wherever you get your podcasts.
The early to mid-1980s saw the height of the AIDS epidemic.
In major cities around the world, medical authorities are monitoring a new mystery killer disease. Known as the gay plague, the disease kills up to 4 out of 10 victims. Most are homosexual men.
Yeah, like whenever I hear tape, you know, of this time, I was so young that I didn't know what was going on, but I can't imagine like the terror of this era.
Yeah, and early on, the onus for AIDS and its spread was placed, you know, squarely on gay people and men in particular. Mm-hmm. I think it's pretty impossible for us to convey what this time was like if you weren't living through it, but people were terrified of contracting it. There was a huge stigma on people who had gotten the disease, and many thought it could just be passed through touch, which wasn't true.
There are two new epidemics sweeping across North America right now. One of them is a medical epidemic, a baffling new disease called acquired immune deficiency syndrome, better known as AIDS, and the other is an epidemic of fear. In some large U.S. cities, the fear is turning into general hysteria. People don't know what AIDS is, how it's contracted, or how it can be cured.
Yeah, there's that now famous moment where Princess Diana at the Middlesex Hospital in London, she's shaking hands without gloves with an AIDS patient just to demonstrate that it was safe to touch a person with AIDS.
Yeah, that was a huge moment. And you have to also remember that in the 80s, being gay, identifying as queer, was still hugely stigmatized. Mm-hmm. And that extended into the art world as well.
Well, one thing about the art world in the 70s and well into the 80s was, as well as being misogynist, it was also homophobic. And the best way to destroy a good art career would be to say you were gay.
This just kind of blows my mind when I think of these very queer art spaces, you know, visual art, film, theater, as being places where you had to be careful. Like, to me, queerness and art are just like, you know, two peas in a pod.
Yeah. And when you look back and realize, I mean, most of the good stuff was being made by gay people.
So we had lots of ways of referring to sexuality in our work, but the media and so on chose to ignore it. It was kind of like, they were going to give us the benefit of the doubt, or they were going to look the other way in order not to destroy our career. That's what I always felt. When the 80s came around, there was a moment where suddenly the video and the performance and all the kind of alternative formats that we were working with in the 70s all went totally out of style almost overnight, and everybody wanted painting again.
So in the early 80s, a museum in Queens asked them to participate in an exhibition, and the theme was beasts. Wild animal paintings, AA told me, were really popular at this time, and so they kind of took it as a challenge.
So what did they create with this theme of wild animals?
So it was a painting of three fucking poodles. So it was, in a sense, a kind of self-portrait, though you couldn't tell whether the poodles were male or female or whatever, and you couldn't really tell what they were doing. But we had an exhibition of poodle paintings then. That was the next thing at the Carmen Lamana Gallery in Toronto, I think probably the next year, that was entirely poodles. And John Mays, who was the critic in the Star, informed the public that the paintings were metaphorical, and they were about three artists working together. Nothing to do with sex.
Oh, yeah. Look at those poodles. I've been to the dog park before, and those poodles are definitely having sex, in my professional opinion.
Oh, yeah. They are. And those poodles would change how the group was able to walk through the art world. AA explained that things changed when a small publication out of Exeter in the UK wrote about the poodles.
And there's a little magazine comes out of Exeter, I think in 85, 86. And presto, there's an article about General Idea and their poodles. And it lays out the whole project of General Idea in terms of queer theory. And that was the first time that had happened. And from then on, there was no problem being queer. You know, like until queer theory existed, it was a big no-no. But once queer theory existed, it was much, much easier to be gay.
And so in 1986, the three of them moved to New York.
We'd kind of, in a sense, used up Canada and knew we had to move on.
1986 was also the height of the AIDS epidemic, with twice as many people getting the disease, and with no cure or stabilizing medications, patients were dying about 15 months after being diagnosed.
And we were living in New York immediately next door on the same block as the St. Vincent's Hospital, which was the primary AIDS hospital. So we were kind of immersed in the AIDS situation. First of all, visiting our friend in the hospital and just being in that downtown scene. It was very, very scary at the time.
And it was there that they got asked to participate in a fundraiser for AIDS research.
I think 26 galleries participated all over Manhattan to raise money for AMFAR, American Foundation for AIDS Research. And our gallery there asked us if we would participate, and we realized we just had to do that painting.
And what is that painting that he's describing there?
It's a piece they created inspired by the pop art painting Love by artist Robert Indiana.
The original red, green, and blue Love logo, you know, which was already internationally famous logo. A teenager in Germany would recognize it as easily as a teenager in Tokyo. You know, it was like really something that had left the art world. So we changed the lettering to say AIDS instead of love and made a 6-foot square painting. And we did the poster project in San Francisco and Seattle and Toronto, and it began to spread like wildfire.
The poster simply read AIDS in bold red letters on a blue and green background. It would go on to become one of the most recognizable artworks in the world. It's an image that's now really synonymous with the AIDS epidemic. But actually, when it first came out, it was really criticized by some AIDS activists for a variety of reasons, like not including information on safe sex, for being too cheerful looking, like it's very bold colors. Mm-hmm. And overall, some felt like it undermined the severity of what was happening. But AA explained that it might have been because General Idea interpreted the original work differently because they were Canadians.
We later realized that the Love logo in the U.S. is universally thought to mean sex. And the Love logo in Canada and in Europe is about, you know, compassion or something more like that, like a universal love. So totally different meaning to the same emblem. So by presenting it first in New York City, by accident, you know, offended all these people. But it's interesting because those people came around rather quickly.
Despite the criticism, General Idea's AIDS logo was a bold message during a really, you know, fearful time full of misinformation mm-hmm. about AIDS. And this focus became even more personal for them when Felix and Jorge were diagnosed as HIV positive.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Their work in the late 1980s and early 1990s began to revolve around AIDS. Here they are talking about the creation of the AIDS logo.
And this is a group, personally, you're not unaffected by AIDS either. General idea, isn't it?
No. I'm HIV positive, or whatever that's worth.
Well, also, that wasn't true at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
None of us were positive at the time.
Yeah, we didn't know at the time.
One of their later works in 1990 is called Fin de siècle. It's a self-portrait of General Idea. Here it is.
Oh, wow, yep, that's three adorable seal pups adrift on an iceberg.
Yeah, and those seal pups were a strategic choice. Here are AA and Jorge talking about the piece with CBC.
Well, one of the issues surrounding AIDS has been the issue of victimization, that especially in relation to the media, that the media represent people living with AIDS, to be correct, as victims of AIDS.
Also related to the media, the fact that it's easier to sell Save the Seal or Save Children with AIDS because they're cuter rather than three middle-aged homosexuals.
Yeah, I mean, there's different meaning. I mean, you can also read into it that for us it's the end of the century too, you know. I mean, it depends how you want to interpret it. I think it has many multiple meanings. And
if you want to be positive, you can say it's sort of looking towards the beginning of the new century. Mm-hmm.
And if you don't?
Then it's looking for the end of this one.
So once Felix and Jorge got diagnosed, did they continue producing art?
They did.
Felix was diagnosed, I think, in 89 and Jorge in 90. And our speed of production started to pick up. And we became very aware that we had to, anything that we wanted to do as a group, we had to at least get down on paper as fast as we could. Because they probably weren't going to live very long. And in 93, we moved back to Toronto. And we just decided to, you know, we were starting to make sales because people thought they're going to die, the prices will go up. And we thought, we don't care what their motive is. If they want to buy it, we're going to sell it to them. So there was a brief moment where the sales started to happen.
When the three of them moved back home to Toronto, the end was close for Felix and Jorge. And while they continued to work, AA also became a caregiver. As sales increased, they decided to take the money from the work they were selling and find the most luxurious place to spend their remaining time together.
We moved back to Toronto, and it was just as a kind of real estate crash had happened. And we moved into the top floor of the Colonnade on Bloor Street, which had just emptied out and was being rented still was very expensive for us, but it was being rented for a fraction of its former rent. And we had, like, I think about 3,000 square feet of space and 3,000 square feet of terrace and a private swimming pool. We had assistants and we were just producing as fast as we could. So there's a huge amount of work from that period. And Jorge and Felix both died in luxury, you know. Jorge died like 3 months after moving in, and Felix another 3 months after that. You know, it was extremely traumatic time. I didn't do a lot for the first 5 years, and then I began to get my act together a bit better after that.
When you work in a collective for so long, your brain is one part of a three. Do you still feel that when you're looking at General Idea's work and when it's going out into the world, that you still think in that, for lack of a better word, hive mind, that it still exists?
Well, you know, around the time we moved to New York, we realized what had become so much of a hive mind that we didn't have to have little like discussion groups about every work to decide whether we were all in agreement. We only did something if we were all in agreement. But we realized that the point at which we brought it up for discussion, we were all automatically all at agreement because our brains had somehow fused by that much. So starting in 86, any idea that any of us came up with, we declared to be general idea. And when they were gone, I really felt, yes, I felt I had, well, I also verbally had their permission to carry these projects out. And I felt that I had the hive mind is a good expression. The hive mind remained in a weird way, and I was able to carry things out the way they would have wanted. I really do believe that. To tell you the truth, I still feel their presence quite strongly at times, especially if I'm doing something they wouldn't like.
They let you know. The hive mind lets you know.
They let me know, yeah.
My name is Jorge Zontel, and this is A.A. Bronson and Felix Barnes. We call ourselves General Idea.
We wanted to be rich, we wanted to be famous, we wanted to be glamorous, we wanted to be artists. This is the story of General Idea.
This episode of The Secret Life of Canada was written and produced by me, Leah Simone Bowen.
And me, Phelan Johnson, with sound design and editing by Graham McDonald.
Script editing is by Yvette Nolan, with research assistance by Andrea Eidinger and CBC Archives. Our logo is by Battle Wogan Illustration and Design.
For CBC Podcasts, the coordinating producer is Roshni Nair, Kate Evans is the senior producer, and the executive producer is Cecil Fernandez. The director of CBC Podcasts is Arif Narani. Share your thoughts on our Spotify feed or reach us by email, secretlifeofcanada@cbc.ca. Thanks for exploring Canada's hidden history with us.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.